This episode of Therapist Connect podcast is sponsored by WebHealer, the number one website provider for private practice therapists. Serving the community for 20 years, WebHealer offers a non-technical and fully supported online platform helping therapists use the internet to grow their practice. Whether you need a website, a booking system, or even a secure email address for your practice, WebHealer can help. Contact WebHealer today via www.webhealer.net and use the coupon Therapist Connect for £100 off their Do It For Me service.
Welcome to the Therapist Connect podcast, a podcast for therapists by therapists.
Welcome to the Therapist Connect podcast. My name is Dr. Peter Blundell, and today I'm back interviewing therapists about their life and work in the counselling and psychotherapy profession. In this interview, I'll be speaking to person-centred therapist Karen Pollock. They are also a supervisor and a trainer who approaches things from an anti-oppressive stance. They have a particular interest in gender, sexuality, and relationship diversity, and they can be found on Twitter under the Twitter handle CounsellingKaz. That's Kaz, K-A-Z.
Thank you for inviting me to come on.
You're very welcome. This is a question I ask absolutely everybody who comes on the podcast, which is possibly a good starting point. Just wondering, how did you come to be a therapist? What was it that drew you to this profession in the first place?
I think, like a lot of people, I'd had really positive experiences of my own personal therapy. Mm. In fact, I think I'm quite old-fashioned on this. I'm quite a strong believer that you must have had quite a deep dive into personal therapy before you even start. Not on the idea that we're fixed or we're better, but to know what it is that mm-hmm. you're getting into. One of the other reasons sounds terribly shallow, but I was looking for a night class because I felt my brain was drying up. And in between sort of Spanish photography, introduction to counselling skills. That was what level one was called. And I just thought it sounded interesting. And it was a 10-week course. It was really odd in some ways. There was some sixth formers were doing it, sort of a real mix of people. And I loved it. One of the things I loved was doing the weekly journal. The idea of doing a process journal, just like, whoa. And I actually found that doing a clear out last summer, because of course lockdown, what do you do except take constantly like redecorate? And it was just, you could see it was just like also new to me. So enjoying doing that, some positive experience of personal therapy, and then sitting down and go, do I actually want to be a Key Stage 1 teacher, which is my previous career? Mm. And thinking, no, Ofsted want me to do 60 learning points for four-year-olds. I don't believe anymore in what I'm being asked to do. Mm. So it was like, okay, let's do the big scary thing of changing my career in my 40s.
I find that's really interesting. So it's like a career shift for you, but also kind of lots of other influences there as well.
It
really resonated with me when you were talking about the 10-week introduction to counselling concepts, because that was my first experiences of counselling training, and I absolutely loved doing that course. And very similar to what you were saying there, kind of the different people who were on it, and kind of everyone came from so many different backgrounds, and kind of just it was all new to everybody. And just sharing that experience for 10 weeks was, I've got some special memories of doing that, really.
I can still picture everyone in the room and the tutor, who was also my tutor for level two and level three, was just, they loved taking people on those first steps.
Yeah.
And you could really tell. And yeah, very, very, very happy memories of doing that.
I think there's something special about those first introductions to counselling and psychotherapy, and very similar. My tutor as well was just so passionate about doing that course, because they loved seeing people kind of be introduced to all of those ideas and the self-awareness and the journaling and all of that kind of thing. Mm. So yeah, it's lovely. So you completed that course, and obviously you continued on to qualify as a counsellor. Can you tell us a little bit about your career so far as a therapist?
Yeah, so I continued on with that, and then I looked locally at the, you know, what was available, and I was really lucky that one of the FE colleges did the 2-year PG dip. Mm-hmm. And it was a very well respected course locally. It'll probably, any students listening to this will hate me and say, but if I say that the placement providers used to come in and pitch to us to go and be students at them rather than us having to find placements.
I'm laughing because I just don't hear of that ever happening at all now. So that's amazing.
Yeah. And the other reason I really chose it is it did a whole unit on abuse, and I already thought maybe that was an area I wanted to go into, but like a lot of people, I think, thought, how do I deal with trauma? What do I do? And it was actually done as one of the core modules. So kind of went into that thinking, you know, maybe I'd like to go into rape crisis or possibly private practice, but probably working with survivors of abuse. And as much as I'd planned it, you know, but during the course of that, because of the things I was blogging about, because of what I was saying on social media, finding that people from gender and sexuality minorities, and then relationship diversity sort of later on, were contacting me saying, will you be my counsellor? And I'm like, I'm not qualified, mate. I can't do that. But you're a counsellor, and I've never heard a counsellor talk about trans rights or queerness or experiences of this, that, and the other. And I'm not that keen on the word niche, because I think it suggests to me it's squishing, and we shouldn't. But I like the word speciality, and people were approaching me, and it kind of made me realize, okay, this trauma, it's there. Obviously, some people will have experienced abuse, but the community seems to be saying to me that they need counselors who also know about all this other stuff through lived experience, through reading, through writing. And so I ended up in private practice with pretty much specializing in gender, sexuality, and relationship diversity. So then, because part of me is just like, yeah, perpetually train, why don't you? I thought, okay, well, this isn't where I thought I'd end up. How do I get some specialist training? Because right now I'm just going with gut feelings and experience, you know, around the GSLD experience. So then I did the 2-year pink therapy postgraduate diploma in gender, sexuality, and relationship diverse therapy. And it just expanded on from there.
It's really interesting. It sounds like such a, I suppose, it's evolution, maybe. Is that the right word? I don't know.
I like that word, yeah.
Of your practice, and almost, it kind of evolved naturally over time.
And a real sign that, you know, just because you think, oh, I'll start working with this group or these particular issues, that might not be the clients who seek you out. And I've done my supervision training this year, and, you know, starting with supervisees, and that, I think that openness to, you might not end up where you think you will, but it might be the right place for you to be practicing. If we're too rigid, people sometimes say that the clients choose their therapist through the smile, and apparently there was some research on that. I'm slightly suspicious of that. I think probably clients don't know why they choose a particular therapist, and they want to say, oh no, it's that photograph. It's like, no, yeah. Something about that person drew you in.
Yeah.
And we can't always draw neat lines around what that something would be.
Yeah. I really like that. I think there is definitely something in that. And from my own experience, that I think people are drawn to each other for lots and lots of different reasons, and we can't always say, oh, it's this or it's that. It's, you know, there's something going on there. And it's really interesting that you kind of see that from clients, that almost your specialism happened because of the clients that were being attracted towards your practice, you know. So that's really interesting. Changing the topic slightly a little bit, I suppose, but how would you define your therapeutic approach, like how your practice and how you work? Has that changed over time?
So my original PGD was person-centered, but it was a very interesting course in that they did psychodynamic CBT and person-centered, and we had to do all the assignments from our own modality, but go to all the lectures and everything from everyone else's. Mm-hmm. But I don't think I'm pluralistic. I think more and more I'm becoming more person-centered over time. I recognize not pure, but I almost think there's something that I would call modern person-centered. Mm-hmm. So if I feel and I own and I completely stand on, I'm going to suggest a blog or a bit of psychoeducation, and I take that completely as coming from me, I feel that's person-centered, not pluralistic or integrative, even though I know more traditional person-centered would be like, well, you're suggesting a blog, you know, isn't that directive? It's like, no, because it's about centering on the needs of the client and using your own awareness of what's going on for you and bringing it, just as you would say, you know, when you say that, I can feel anger inside myself, or, you know, when you say what happened to you, I can feel sadness. Well, if that's pure person-centered, why isn't, when you talk about asexuality, I'm wondering if you've seen a website called Avon, because I think you might find something useful there. I'm not really sure that steps out of person-centered. Person-centered works, and I just believe that. So.
I find it really interesting that you, so you trained in person-centered, but then these other things, which some people might not consider person-centered, but you feel like you've almost become more person-centered as time's gone on. So I find that really, really interesting.
I think I've seen the Gloria video. I mean, you must have also seen it probably far too many times. I can't believe Rogers, that he's so warm in that. I can't believe he just sat there reflecting and summarizing with all of his clients. There will have been more, because he's too human. And I think we almost ritualized what was meant to be a lot more real than just, here is my summary, here's my reflection. Ooh, look at me empathize. Sorry, that was quite dismissive.
But also it's that, I always think about it in terms of genuineness, like being authentic, like, you know, there is different aspects of ourselves that we bring into the therapeutic relationship, and we're mindful about what we bring in, you know, but it's got to be authentic, hasn't it? You know, if you're just like a robot, you know, reflecting back or just nodding constantly, you know.
With the head tilt.
Yeah, with the head tilt, you know. It's, you know, there's some of that, but if that's all you do, then yeah, it does. You don't, I don't think someone feels like a real person almost.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. Connection happens between two human beings.
Yeah. Yeah. And all the messiness that goes along with that.
Oh, yes.
Thinking about connection, because we're on the Therapist Connect podcast, I was wondering, how do you see the wider therapy community, and how connected do you feel to other therapists or the wider community?
I think there are different levels of connection. Definitely feel very connected to the pink therapy community. Really miss, and didn't realise how much it was a part of my year, the yearly conference at the East Revan London. Mm-hmm. It was sort of part conference, part convention, part reunion.
Yeah.
But I think a lot of people who work, therapists in private practice, live very solitary lives. And we'd all, there's this lovely moment afterwards where it's quite usual for a whole bunch of us like to go to the pub and just have a pint as if to say, yeah, you know, we're a community. And definitely felt, well, still feel connected to that, but I'm missing the in-person, obviously. The wider community, different connections on different levels. There's some people I love reading, love interacting with. There's some people I feel very far away from, but I think that's okay because their experience is so very different to mine. You know, I am a queer person. I am a queer therapist. I'm not going to fit in with a lot of the 2.4 Volvo and the drive and how do I navigate all these different things. But there are plenty of people who do connect with that. And then maybe this smaller circle of people with me over here sort of looking, that's not us, but there are some of us who connect together.
Mm. There's something about that when you were talking, I was thinking about the importance of finding those connections or community or whatever it is that's right for us, you know?
Yeah.
And when you were talking, I was thinking that there's so many different communities out there now as therapists, which is quite amazing, really, I think, but sometimes what I think about it. But just how it was important to you to find, I was going to say your people almost, but do you know what I mean? All the people that you connect with, the, you know, the most as therapists.
I think we have to be very careful using words like tribe because, you know, they have racial overtones and cultural appropriation, but there are different therapeutic tribes for DeafNet, and finding the right one and the one that you fit in is so important just to nourish yourself.
I definitely think there's something in that. And I suppose one of the things that I've found is actually sometimes I get different things from different communities, you know.
Yeah. I think that's what I miss. That's what I miss because of the pandemic. I was planning before this happened to see if I could get together a little sort of northeast in-person coffee meetup or something. Mm-hmm. Not queer orientated, just, you know, cancers in the northeast, let's meet once a month for coffee. Because I think you do need different communities you go to for different stuff. And a much more casual, let's just, you know, see what each other are doing and is anyone going to like this training day or, you know, heard about this, would have been quite nice. And that matey kind of community isn't easy to find, or at least maybe possibly in the big cities easier to find.
Yeah, I think there's definitely something in that in terms of where you're located, how difficult it can be to find some of those in-person communities. And I think I've really valued some of the online communities there, but there is a difference, isn't there, from, as you say, being able to sit in the pub or a cafe with somebody and have coffee or whatever and have a chat, relaxed chat. It's different from having a Zoom, you know, meeting or whatever it is.
And a couple of the Facebook groups are lovely for that casual kind of banter and chat, but sometimes or at least I should say, I shouldn't speak for anyone else. I think it would be nice to have smaller groups where you just spend a little bit more time together. But as you say, I'm sure in bigger cities that's much more common.
But I mean, just talking about that idea of private practice, you know, there is so many therapists who contacted me in terms of talking about loneliness, actually being in private practice and not having those in-person communities. And I think I almost feel like it's even more difficult now, you know, because of the pandemic to actually not only find those communities, but, you know, have them and make them happen and for people to come along. I think that's quite challenging, I think, for a lot of people.
And I think in some ways I was quite lucky because I'd left teaching and was self-employed doing like various projects, like one of the things I did was I did music schemes for young children. So before I actually went into private practice, I was quite used to being self-employed. Mm-hmm. And I know in this, I'm going to say this comes directly from Facebook groups, really, a lot of people don't really consider that what they're doing is starting their own business and being self-employed, and then it hits them because they've been used to going into work each day, the staff room or the, you know, wherever they mix the water cooler, and they lose everything at a really stressful time when they're trying to launch a business.
Yeah.
I didn't realize how lucky I was that I'd already kind of done that bit.
Yeah. But I think it's maybe that disconnect sometimes in terms of this desire to work in private practice and thinking about all the benefits of what it might be like. But then also maybe some people forget those potential downsides to that, which is, you know, you don't have those colleagues and peers that you can chat to in work, you know, and it is maybe more lonely than people possibly expect it to be. Yeah.
I think it would help an awful lot of people if on their original training, you know, a tutor sat down almost as career development and said, okay, do you want to be self-employed or do you want to work for someone? Because I sometimes get the impression people haven't even considered, okay, which suits me? Which option actually is who I am in the world?
And I think that's really good advice. And I think you can't start thinking about that early enough. You know, as you're training and developing, yeah, you might be thinking, oh, I've got to get through my placement, I've got to do this, I've got to do that. There's no reason why you can't start thinking about, well, what kind of career would I like after I'm qualified, you know?
Because it hugely influenced, you know, what type of placements you're looking for or even where you study.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Takes some thought and consideration. And there's so many different possible routes and types of placement and ways people can train that trying to give it some consideration beforehand. I do think that's quite important, I think. Thinking about the profession, I suppose, within the UK could be broader. What do you think is the kind of the biggest challenge that we're facing right now that we need to consider?
I've got to choose just one.
Well, I know it's a really
they're all.
You can have more than one if you want.
They're all kind of interlinked. I think we need to professionalise, as in be a profession in the technical sense, because we're not. Which means we need to be like teaching, nursing, medicine. A title that you can only take if you have a certain level of qualification. But at the same time, we have a huge problem with, we are far too white, we are far too middle class, we are far too cis. The biggest problem is how to square that circle. We need to attract far more people. You know, I'm a working class person from Benwell who, sort of by luck as much as anything, ended up with an awful lot of privileges. There aren't many other people who have grown up in a bit of Benwell that I did who can say today that, you know, they're a therapist with a full private practice. We can't just keep saying, oh, well, we need to attract different people. And if they're not coming, there's a reason. But that, I suspect that some of the reforms that have been done previously, especially around like who can offer training, what counts as accredited training, were done. Look, we are widening. And I don't think that was the solution. I just think it meant it's even harder for us now to be heard by people like the NHS. You know, on average, the NHS is saying they want a level 7 to work for them. And people at level 4 are told you're qualified to work with people three-level gap.
Yeah.
I actually think, and this probably is controversial, the mistake was made years ago when nursing became a degree subject, counselling should have gone, yeah, that looks like a good idea. And gone the same route that other professions did of how do we attract more working class, more BME, more LGBTQ students into our courses. And instead, we just keep saying there's the same problem and not changing it.
And I mean, I definitely agree that we keep saying there's the same problem and it, we're not changing it. I think we have different views in terms of how we go about that, which I think is fine. I suppose what you're talking about there is you think maybe professionalizing would help the profession and also then maybe give us opportunities to increase the diversity of practitioners who are coming into training. If by focusing on recruiting those people to those programs. Yeah.
I think so. You see, most of the objections to professionalisation that I hear from people are, but we're already so white, middle class, cis. Mm-hmm. And I get that. But I don't think that should mean we shouldn't professionalise more. I think that means we should try harder to work out why those groups aren't coming into the profession. It's not okay to say we can't do something because this thing that is happening now will continue to happen. Well, because that's not fixing it.
Yeah.
But
and I suppose for me the key bit is what do we mean by professionalisation, you know, and how
we'll not scope it.
Yeah.
But we do need higher standards. We need far higher standards, you know. We need to have mandatory training in trauma, as far as I'm concerned, and abuse. Before you cannot be working with someone and hear the sort of things that we will both have heard said to victims of child sex abuse and rape. Mm. Mm. We need mandatory working with minorities. People have to have worked on themselves on racism, transphobia, homophobia, biphobia. And those are nice for the additional extras. Oh, look, we did a human development day. We've, you know.
And that is something I completely agree with. That type of training should be throughout all training, you know, that happens for counselling and psychotherapy. And I think I would agree with that in terms of if that's what you mean by professionalisation, is actually there is certain things that should be not optional, you know, in terms of what is
the standard of what you should have covered before you get a certificate saying yes, you're a counsellor needs to be weighed. I mean, the only objection I have to it being master's level, and I think master's level should exist, is I think from a class basis, some people are intimidated, which is why it breaks my heart that there aren't as many FE colleges offering the kind of course I did now. Because FE has just been decimated. And I actually think if there were more of those old-fashioned, and they used to cost a couple of £100 as well, you know. Mm. The PG dip when I started it, I think it was £350.
Yeah.
If there were more of those, you would get more non-white students, you'd get more working-class students, because it's the local tech, not the big scary university doing a master's. I think there's a place for both. And I think both should have equally stringent measures.
Mm.
But
they're just, and I would agree with that. And I think what we're talking about is the topics that are covered on those programs. The academic assessment may be different, you know, in terms of the
mine was very vocational, which I loved. It was an old fashioned FE course.
Yeah, absolutely. And how that can be. That can be, well, I think that would be very valuable in terms of developing therapists and how if we just focus on the academic side, that actually it just loses so much, I think. Mm. And yeah, so I think I mean, actually, we do agree more there than what I originally thought from that initial discussion. Yeah.
Remember what I said about making it into a degree was, you know, when nursing did it, which was the Project 2000. I know about this. Family members are nurses. You know, that ship has sailed, horses bolted, lazy metaphor, whatever you want. I just think a mistake was made way back when other vocations like nursing went, how do we move this forward? How do we get more respect?
And my worry with that, Karen, is that who has the control and power over those things, you know, and which direction that they go in, and that, you know, with scope ed or anything along those lines, is who's making those decisions.
Again, I wouldn't start from here. We need an equivalent of the Nursing and Midwifery Council rather than three or four membership organisations having the power. You know, and I don't know enough of the history. I don't know how that something like that got formed. But there's too much jockeying for power at the moment. You know, which organisation gets heard by government, which organisation gets to make the rules. But I don't see how that benefits us or clients. Mm. I've joked sometimes that they'll take the title of psychotherapist out of my cold, dead hands because I didn't study Nietzsche for nothing. But it's, how are they going to define these things that really are about whose voice has been listened to in a moment? My first degree was philosophy, logic, and scientific method at the LSE. You know, and if you're studying Hegel, you're studying Nietzsche, you're studying Schopenhauer, you're studying the people that Freud and Jung learnt from. Scopa just draws lines where lines don't exist. And I don't claim that made me a psychotherapist. I'd be willing to take them to court if they try to stop me using the term.
And I think that is a really big problem if any of the terms are taken as or changed, or, you know, forcing people to use or not use certain titles. Again, it's so problematic because there are so many different people who use and interpret those in so many different ways. How can one or a group of organisations take control of that, really?
I think what we just need to do is make sure that there are minimum, and I don't mean minimum there is low, but actually quite a high bar of minimum standards that says you are safe to work with vulnerable human beings who are hurting. You will not cause harm. And we don't, some courses do. I will name no names or you might blush. I think some courses are doing that quite well. But until they all are, that has to be fixed.
And that, I agree with that. And I also think that's where the focus should be in terms of thinking about
not what title across. People have had, or you can see people with supervision, and no, because if everybody was leaving safe to work, then call yourself an inner chakra guide if you want to. I don't really care. You're not going to hurt people.
So my kind of last question, or one of us, coming to the last question. And you've mentioned your work around gender, sexuality, and relationship diversity. Also, I don't know whether you would use this label actually, but I see you as a bit of an activist as well in terms of that. And I'm just wondering, particularly on social media, and you mentioned before, like writing blogs and things like that. I just wondered what kind of impact that had on you, you know, doing that kind of work.
It's been interesting. I mean, I don't really sit comfortably with the term activist as an identity. And there's long, complex stuff around that I think it's quite an othering term. They're activists, so we don't need to listen to them.
Oh, I see, yeah.
Yeah, but also I just think this is what being a decent human being is about. You know, if good people do nothing in the face of evil and harm, then evil and harm grows. I was already quite vocal, especially about LGBTQ rights before I qualified. And I kind of noticed, especially when I first started, that very few people gave opinions in the way I did, or tried to educate in the way I did. And a lot of my social media works at trying to educate. So where does the term cis come from? Or what is conversion therapy, or things like that? And I realize it's because it's seen as small P, maybe even big P, political by people. I'm very strongly anti-oppressive. We can't say we want the best or self-actualization or whatever you want to use for our clients in the room and then say, ah, but they can get a lot of shit out there. That's not my problem. I don't feel comfortable with, you see me for 50 minutes and I'm going to just leave the world as being pretty terrible to you, because that's not my job. I actually think if we're going to live by the codes of conduct that all the regulatory bodies put out there, then we have to try and make the world a better place. In terms of impact, negative or positive? Positive, met wonderful people like you. Negative, I must have one of the longest block lists on Twitter. I haven't been on Mumsnet for a couple of months, so that's nice. And they aren't speculating anymore on whether I'm a trans woman, which was a fun bit of Mumsnet to go into. And apparently you could see my masculine jawline, which was very amusing.
I think that's almost, I suppose, why I see you as an activist, because I do see you put yourself out there. And I know you don't relate to that term, but there is, it's a lot of work, and there is a lot of risks to that, you know, and that's why I was interested in the impact on you, because, you know, a lot of people might not see some of that aspect of some of that that goes on, you know.
And I think if anyone was thinking of taking up the baton, please do. I came into this already from different aspects of my life, different identities, being very familiar with how horrific being doxxed, social media. You have to be prepared for the absolute worst. Self-care has to come first. No cause is ever helped by having another victim along the way. The Mumsnet's, now the Mumsnet stuff and things just amuses me. It's just like, especially because they pretty much were convinced I was a trans woman for ages. And I'm like, that's just hilarious, really. And really sad, because they can't imagine someone not sharing an identity but caring. And that's one of the saddest things I could ever imagine. You know, what are the defining moments of my teen years, this shows my age, was the video from Ethiopia that launched Band-Aid. And I can remember it made me realize the world was very big and we had to do something. I'm not even getting into politics, whether he did the right or wrong thing. I was, 13, 12. Would they really watch that and not be sobbing at the end? Because I don't know those people, so I don't care.
I feel like what you're saying is it's always been part of you, you know, and it's part of who you are. So that's why you don't identify with that label of activist, because
I think so, yeah.
It's you, and it's what you care about.
But if other people do, you know, I get it. And sometimes I think having an identity, it goes back to community. We can be activists together, and that's really important. I just, if people are going to step up, do it understanding that you need to be able to switch off and log off and turn away. You know, you rarely see me on Twitter of an evening, because that's my downtime, my family time, my, you know, can I go and kill things on the Xbox time? You got to have really strong boundaries, because it'll overwhelm you otherwise.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Karen, I've absolutely loved this chat. I really have. It's been really lovely. And just to I get to know you a little bit better as well. But it's been lovely.
It's been wonderful.
I do hope you get to Liverpool and we can go out for that coffee or drink.
Yes. Nice. And what are you doing in 2023? Shall we put something in the diet?
Schedule it. Oh, thank you so much. And yeah, thanks so much for being on the Therapist Connect podcast.
Thank you for inviting me. It's been a wonderful conversation.
Thank you for listening to the Therapist Connect podcast. Go to www.therapist-connect.com for more discussions and debates.
This episode of Therapist Connect podcast is sponsored by WebHealer, the number one website provider for private practice therapists. Serving the community for 20 years, WebHealer offers a non-technical and fully supported online platform helping therapists use the internet to grow their practice. Whether you need a website, a booking system, or even a secure email address for your practice, WebHealer can help. Contact WebHealer today via www.webhealer.net and use the coupon Therapist Connect for £100 off their Do It For Me service.